a large swath of the U.S. will be plunged into darkness. The air will turn cold.
People in funny cardboard glasses will turn to the heavens, mouth agape, and birds will go silent.
It's a total solar eclipse, and it's totally awesome. Hey, Dean.
Hey, Lucy.
So, Dean.
Yeah?
Got any plans for the eclipse?
Well, as a matter of fact, I do.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May.
And I'm astronomer Dean Regas, host of the Looking Up podcast, and today we're venturing into the path of totality.
That was really good. So, Dean, tell me about those plans for the solar eclipse. When will the solar eclipse happen, and where will you be?
Well, this will be on Monday, April 8th, and this is something that's been on my calendar for a long time. I mean, seeing a total solar eclipse is the ultimate astronomical event. It is the most amazing thing you'll ever see in your life. Did I lay it on too thick? No. It's really, really cool. And so, April 8th, this is the big day. And where I'm going to be, I'm not exactly entirely sure.
So is that because you're an eclipse chaser? Do you consider yourself an eclipse chaser?
Yeah, absolutely, because I have extreme FOMO. I do not want to be clouded out from any eclipse. So I'm a weather watcher also the week before the eclipse. And so I will watch the weather and see what's happening. And so I've been poring over the maps, and I think I have a place where it's going to be clear.
Okay. And is that the definition of an eclipse chaser? Is it somebody who has to be or will make every effort to be where the eclipse is best viewed?
Absolutely. It's about going to the right place at the right time. And with total solar eclipses, the path of totality is so narrow. So you have to go to these very kind of exotic places around the world at different times of the decade here. But for this one, it's not very far from the tri-state. It's really close to us. And hopefully we won't have to drive too far to get to the path of totality.
What else are you doing? Like getting the tune-up on the car, checking your tires, getting new brakes? I mean, are you like totally prepping this whole thing?
It's possible. I've been preparing for a couple of years. But because the last one was in 2017. A lot of people went down to Kentucky and Tennessee to see that one. And so, once that one's over, this one was on my radar. So the car's ready to go, gassed up. I got snacks packed in the back there. I got my solar glasses. I got my filters. I got my telescopes. So, I'm ready to go.
Wow. Who were some of the early eclipse chasers, and where did they go?
Well, so it's kind of a newer phenomenon because it's not the fact that, that we couldn't predict eclipses, because people back in the old days, in the 1700s, 1800s, they would travel around the world and the explorers would go to these places. But it was mostly just for the astronomers. It was mostly for the people that were on expeditions. And so, and even some that were in the 19th century were a pretty big deal, where astronomers would leave the East Coast and go out west to see these things in the Wild West. But that was mostly for astronomers. And but it's really more the 20th century, late 20th century, where it became kind of a tourist thing, where the general public could say, I want to go on vacation. I want to see these exotic places. I want to go to Patagonia, or I want to go to Africa, and I want to go to these places. And it's an excuse to go to those places and then see the eclipse while you're doing it.
And for these early astronomers, before everyday folks like me, I mean, you're an astronomer, so you're one of these fancy people who 200 years ago could have been chasing eclipse. But for regular people like me, I understand it's newer. But for these early astronomers, who were some of the people who really went all out to be where they thought the eclipse would be best viewed?
Well, the big one that I remember is, yeah, because I was there back in 1870 something.
You look so young.
So in the mid 1800s, it was a big deal to kind of go out. There was an American eclipse out west, and so people went to to Denver, which was the Wild West out there back then, and so eclipse chasers from the East Coast and from even the Cincinnati Observatory went out by train out there, and they carted all their equipment, all their telescopes and everything like that. And the one that I like to think of the most was that this whole expedition went out to Pike's Peak out in Colorado. And they thought, well, why don't we just go up to the top of Pike's Peak and watch the eclipse? Sure, why not? That sounds good. Well, one of the astronomers got altitude sickness from going all the way up there. And so they had to cart him down during the eclipse, and he was like, I must see it, I must see it, and he's watching it as he's like being like carried down the mountain almost near death.
Wow, that is some dedication. I hope it doesn't come to that for you, Dean.
No, I hope not either. I think the worst part is, you know, and for people that are eclipse chasers now, the big thing is to find a place with an accessible bathroom. That's yes. The main thing. Because, yeah, you'll be out there for a while watching the partial stages, because it takes about an hour to go from the partial eclipse to the total eclipse. And that part's really cool, too. So don't miss out on the early parts as well.
Yeah, time your potty breaks appropriately. Why will this particular eclipse be so spectacular and special?
Well, this one is because it's going to be so close to us. It's not like this is an exceptionally long one. It's more of just the proximity. And, you know, we don't have very many of them in the United States. You know, the one in 2017 was the first one in 39 years.
The last solar eclipse to be visible in North America until the year 2017 was invisible to New Jerseyans today. We'll have a report.
And so this one having two kind of close together is nice. I think the other part about this one is that there won't be another one in the United States till 2044. That will be in Montana, pretty much only in Montana and Canada. And then 2045 goes across the southern United States. So I'm a patient man, but 20 years, come on. This one also, for folks who remember the one in 2017, this one will be a little bit longer. So if you're in the center line, it'll be about 4 minutes of totality versus the one in 2017 was about 2.5 minutes.
Is the sun more active now too? Does that make a difference?
The sun is a little more active. We're kind of nearing what's called solar maximum, the cycle every 11 years where the sun has more activity. And so that is going to be an interesting factor when people are going to take pictures, because that might show up in the pictures as these extra, if you kind of imagine that picture of the total solar eclipse as black hole with this wispy clouds around it. That's the corona of the sun, the outer atmosphere of the sun. And so with an active sun, you might have a little bit bigger of a corona. You also want to look for these prominences, solar, they're kind of like solar flares. They'll appear as little pink protuberances sticking outside of the ring. And in 2017, I didn't notice them, but my first total solar eclipse I saw in 2006 in the Mediterranean Sea, you could see a solar prominence during totality, naked eye. And so that's the first time I'd ever seen a solar eruption with the naked eye. It was so cool.
Wow, that sounds really cool. Eclipses are a big deal. How have they shaped history?
Well, it's not exactly like they're, you know, like changing the forces of history. There are pretty some minor examples of, you know, when some of the explorers would go around the world, and Christopher Columbus is kind of the infamous one that he used a lunar eclipse to curry favor with the population that were not really happy with him. And basically,
weren't his men doing some pretty terrible things?
It wasn't exactly, yeah, his shining moment. And so he, you know, the story is that he said, you know, a lunar eclipse is coming, or, you know, I'll turn the sky red, or turn the moon red. And, you know, of course it happened. And then the natives were like, whoa, they looked at Columbus a little differently. So not exactly the best way to use an eclipse. But I think the other one that sticks out to me is, well, there's actually two things about solar eclipses. The total solar eclipses in the 19th century were also used to look for things close to the sun. Like, there was this theory that there was another planet between Mercury and the sun called Vulcan. I kid you not. And this planet Vulcan was observed by four different astronomers at two different times. And so astronomers wasted a lot of time looking for Vulcan during the 19th century eclipses, including the ones up on Pike's Peak. And they never found it. And so the people that supposedly saw Vulcan, I just got to think they were just staring at the sun too long.
Yeah, yeah. All they had to do was wait for Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So, I mean, it's interesting that, yeah, there was a thing that was a search for this planet Vulcan, which, yep, turned out to not happen.
Yeah.
And then the other one was in the 20th century where Mercury was at play again, that Mercury wasn't in the place where normal physics says it should be. And Einstein comes along and gives his theory of relativity that says, okay, this explains why Mercury is moving in a different direction. And during the eclipse, that was a big study. They say, okay, we're going to look for Mercury. Einstein says it should be there. Bingo, it was. Einstein, genius.
There you go. Oh, well, that's what makes him Einstein, I guess. How have cultures interpreted and explained eclipses over time? There are some really interesting explanations that people came up with.
The Egyptian pharaohs believed they were the representatives of the sun god Ra, and the iris of an eye is often seen in their artwork, such as the Eye of Horus. Similarly, the ancient Nazca culture of South America believed that the sun and the moon were the separate eyes of the sky-dwelling gods. There is a very good reason for this belief. A total solar eclipse bears an uncanny similarity to an eye in the sky.
Yeah, I mean, every culture that's experienced these, it had to have left them kind of shaken, and mostly it is a horrifying thing. I mean, imagine that you're not expecting this. I mean, I'm expecting it, and I see the sun's gone. You know, you look up and the sun's gone, and there's these legends around that because they're so rare, like they happen in any one place about every 360 years or so. So if you experience those, then you're really shaken by this and you're really thinking, wow, the heavens are alive. The heavens are playing tricks and they're also doing a lot of weird things. And so it was mostly a negative thing when a total solar eclipse had happened. So, in Eastern cultures, it was thought of like kind of a dragon and dragon eating things. And in Middle Eastern cultures, it was more of a thing like you have to scare away the eclipse. Like it was, so this is still a tradition around a lot of places around the world where you bang pots and pans, yell to scare the eclipse out so the sun will return back to normal. And, from my two total solar eclipse experiences, the people I was around were yelling and screaming too because it was crazy. And I don't think they're trying to get the sun back, but they were yelling because it was such amazing kind of, primal event. And so that'll be very curious for people that are seeing this for the first time, their feelings and recollections. And so I really encourage people to, like, if you're a journaler or even if you're not, write down your thoughts that night of what you saw, because it's really powerful.
Yeah. I'm talking with astronomer Dean Regas, host of the Looking Up podcast, in this recorded interview about the total solar eclipse. Dean, how have eclipses been incorporated into mythologies or even literature? I mean, they have played a role in stories over time, haven't they?
Yeah, I'm an interesting fiction reader every once in a while because I always gravitate to stories about astronomers. So it's a very subgenre of fiction. But it does show up in a lot of science fiction. There's stories and even movies. There's short stories about when all the suns of a planet get eclipsed and they're plunged into darkness and how the society changes. That's a short story called Nightfall. But then there's also a similar movie out there, a very lesser known movie called Pitch Black, which does a similar thing with Vin Diesel.
But when darkness fell,
a total eclipse,
he was the only one deadly enough to fight this kind of evil.
And it ain't me you gotta worry about now.
Pitch Black. Own the special edition DVD. Out now.
I highly recommend it. It's fun to watch. But then there's also some other minor astronomical things that come into literature. There is a play out there where an astronomer had to decide between his love or his trip to see the transit of Venus when Venus goes in front of the sun, happens twice every 100 years. And spoiler alert, he chooses the transit of Venus over his fiance.
Dang. Well, it's hard to be understanding when you make. I guess if you're the fiance,
it's hard to compete with the heavens. I'm sorry. When you're looking up, it's a tough one.
Yeah. Well, I think an eclipse was a big plot point in Mark Twain's A Yankee in King Arthur's Court too, if I'm remembering correctly. But I might not be because I'm. You know, who knows? So, eclipses have come at some pivotal points throughout time. Are there any times, you mentioned Christopher Columbus, are there any other times where folks have said, "Ooh, gosh, this really means something," or have used it to their advantage, or?
Not really. That's the thing is that, you know, all of the ones in the 20th century and 21st century, I mean, these are all very well understood things. So there's not a lot of superstition about these things. And the thing is that they're so rare for any one spot. I mean, just think of our whole generation before the eclipse in 2017, all across the United States, hardly anybody had ever seen a total solar eclipse. So it really wasn't something that it's not frequent enough to be useful to manipulate in a lot of ways. That's the thing. So it's more of a just like, it's part of folklore of, wow, I, you know, grandma remembered seeing this kind of thing and talks about this, but it's such a localized event. And so few people saw them that it really was more of this kind of like mystery. Outside of the astronomy realm. And so that's what's so amazing about this century is that now this is accessible to so many people. I mean, the eclipse in 2017, that was by far the most Americans that had ever seen eclipse at one time. And this one here is going to be similar because it's closer to the East Coast, so more people on the East Coast will go to it. So this could be the most viewed solar eclipse in history. So that's what I think is really exciting about this, is that this is a guaranteed wow. It's going to happen. You're going to be moved. And the only thing you got to watch out for is those pesky clouds. April weather in the Ohio Valley.
Why? What benefits have eclipses had for science? You mentioned how astronomers helped Albert Einstein prove his theory of relativity, which, you know, now that's why people call smart people Einsteins, I guess. What other benefits have they had? What have people learned from them?
Yeah, the other person I go back to is Kepler. And so Johannes Kepler back in the 17th century, he's in this time period where you're kind of in between superstition and science. And he's trying to navigate those and trying to make a prediction as to where things are going to be. And this was always the field of astronomy, is like, okay, we want to predict what's going to happen in the sky because that helps us keep our time, keep our calendars, that kind of thing. And so he's looking at eclipses. He's looking at all this data from other things. And it gets to the point where he comes up with this new math, this new idea of how orbits are working. And he's able to basically predict all eclipses for the rest of time.
Wow.
And because the first eclipse predictors, from what we can tell from historic records, go back to Babylonia. So thousands of years ago, they could predict them. And they would get kind of senses as to when they would happen. Like, okay, there's a pattern here. We've got most of the pattern. We can't tell you the exact second it's going to start. And then we see other cultures, too, like in Maya culture, they were very good at predicting eclipses as well. But in talking to historians about it, their way of predicting is a little different than Kepler's. Like, he could pin it down to the exact second where you got to see it and when you'll see it. Some of the other cultures would look at this and they would say something like, oh, you know, if there's an eclipse today, don't be surprised. That's kind of like they hedge their bet.
Spoiler alert.
Because the simple pattern is you have an eclipse about every 177 days. But sometimes things are off by just a little bit and it skips it. And so they would notice this and say, okay, 177, 177, oops, skip that one, next 177. And so they couldn't get narrowed down to the exact second until Kepler could pretty much do it.
Oh, really interesting. Science is always changing. Do you think astronomers of the future might look back at what we know about eclipses today and kind of have a chuckle?
That one, I don't know so much about it. It's because I do get asked that a lot. So what can we learn from solar eclipses today? And, you know, most of my answer is, you know, we kind of learned it all that we're going to learn about it. I know there's some finer points about solar activity, and the corona of the sun is probably the place where most can be learned about, because that wispy cloudy stuff around the eclipse, that's the outer atmosphere of the sun, and it's away from the surface of the sun. So the sun's interior is, you know, in the millions of degrees. Its surface is about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit, but then you go farther from the sun, you think it's going to get cooler. The corona is 1 million degrees. And this is still a mystery as to why this area farther from the sun is warmer than the surface of the sun. And so there's a lot of studies that can be done about that. During eclipses, you don't have a lot of time. That's the thing. So it's more like solar spacecrafts are really finding out more about that. So to me, the amount of information that's going to be gathered during those 4 minutes of totality are pretty small. But so I think that the main thing about this is the public. I mean, that's the real thing. Because I'll be honest, I'm not doing any science that day. I'm going to be like everybody else, mouth open, staring, screaming, yelling, taking the whole thing in. Because that's the real experience. That it really just blows your mind. It's really amazing. So that's what I'm looking for. So my science hat is out, is off, and my public appreciation eclipse crazy person will be ready.
Yeah, you're just gonna fan out on this.
Exactly.
Thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with astronomer Dean Regas, who is host of the Looking Up podcast, in this recorded interview. And Dean, tell us a little bit, if people want to learn more about the eclipse, you've got a Looking Up episode that's a deep dive into the eclipse. Tell us a little bit about that, which is posted on our website now. People can listen is right after they've heard this. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. It's, getting people excited about the eclipse has been kind of a multi-year thing. This is the latest one. And we spoke with the director at the Armstrong Air and Space Museum, Dante Centauri.
Well, Dante, thanks so much for joining me today.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me. This is great.
So before we get into the big eclipse, tell us about one of the most famous little towns in Ohio, Wapakoneta, and its claim to space fame.
Yes, Wapakoneta, Ohio, which is actually was a Jeopardy question not too long ago. Our claim to fame is that it's the hometown of astronaut Neil Armstrong.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And they are looking at this because they are like the center line of the eclipse up in Wapakoneta, Ohio. This is where Neil Armstrong was born. And so we talked about the preparations that a small town can have, is you're going to have tens of thousands of people descending upon you. So that is definitely one of my go-to places. If the weather is clear, I might be up in Wapakoneta with them. But it's a great way to look at, kind of what to expect, how to see it safely, and all that. And so for timing for us around the Cincinnati region, what we're looking at is the start of the partial eclipse will be at about 1:52 in the afternoon. That's when you can start to see that little bit of moon blocking out the sun. And that's when you can start using those glasses, those special solar eclipse glasses, to look at it and watch the progression of the moon covering more and more of the sun. And then 3:09, 3:10, that's where we get maximum eclipse in the Cincinnati area. But if you're farther west or north, that's when you get totality. So, that's my big hope and my big message to the Cincinnatians out there is get out of the city on April 8th. I've been seeing all these websites of like, what's the best place in Cincinnati to observe the eclipse? I'm like, nowhere. There is nowhere in Cincinnati, because it will not be a total solar eclipse in Cincinnati. get out of the city, please. I beg you. You got to see this with me. It's awesome.
Okay. Well, that's Dean Regas, host of the Looking Up podcast and astronomer extraordinaire. Thanks so much for your time, Dean.
Oh, my pleasure. Keep looking up, everybody.
Up next, we'll talk surge pricing, shrinkflation, and skimpflation, and what all that means for our wallets. This is Cincinnati Edition.